From Volume 2, Winston Churchill's Second World War Memoirs, Chapter 1, The National Coalition.
Now, at last, the slowly gathered, long pent up fury of the storm broke upon us. 4 or 5 millions of men met each other in the first shock of the most merciless of all the wars of which record has been kept. Within a week, the front in France, behind which we had been accustomed to dwell through the long years of the former war and the opening phase of this, was to be irretrievably broken. Within 3 weeks, the long-famed French army was to collapse in rout and ruin, and the British army to be hurled into the sea with all its equipment lost. Within 6 weeks, we were to find ourselves alone, almost disarmed, with triumphant Germany and Italy at our throats, with the whole of Europe in Hitler's power, and Japan glowering on the other side of the globe. It was amid these facts and looming prospects that I entered upon my duties as Prime Minister and Minister of Defense, and addressed myself to the first task of forming a government of all parties to conduct His Majesty's business at home and abroad, by whatever means might be deemed best suited to the national interest. 5 years later, almost to a day, it was possible to take a more favorable view of our circumstances. Italy was conquered and Mussolini slain. The mighty German army surrendered unconditionally. Hitler had committed suicide. In addition to the immense captures by General Eisenhower, nearly 3 million German soldiers were taken prisoners in 24 hours by Field Marshal Alexander in Italy and Field Marshal Montgomery in Germany. France was liberated, rallied and revived. Hand in hand with our allies, the two mightiest empires in the world, we advanced to the swift annihilation of Japanese resistance. The contrast was certainly remarkable. The road across these 5 years was long, hard and perilous. Those who perished upon it did not give their lives in vain. Those who marched forward to the end will always be proud to have trodden it with honor. It is probably easier to form a cabinet, especially a coalition cabinet, in the heat of battle than in quiet times. The sense of duty dominates all else, and personal claims recede. Once the main arrangements had been settled with the leaders of the other parties, with the formal authority of their organizations, the attitude of all those I sent for was like that of soldiers in action who go to the places assigned to them at once, without question. The party basis being officially established, it seemed to me that no sense of self entered into the minds of any of the very large number of gentlemen I had to see. If some few hesitated, it was only because of public considerations. Even more did this high standard of behavior apply to the large number of conservative and national liberal ministers who had to leave their offices and break their careers at this moment of surpassing interest and excitement, and to step out of official life, in many cases, forever. The Conservatives had a majority of more than 120 over all other parties in the House combined. Mr. Chamberlain was their chosen leader. I could not but realize that his supersession by me must be very unpleasant to many of them, after all my long years of criticism and often fierce reproach. Besides this, it must be evident to the majority of them that my life had been passed in friction or actual strife with the Conservative Party, that I had left them on free trade and had later returned to them as Chancellor of the Exchequer. After that, I had been for many years their leading opponent on India, on foreign policy, and on the lack of preparations for war. To accept me as Prime Minister was to them very difficult. It caused pain to many honourable men. Moreover, loyalty to the chosen leader of the party is the prime characteristic of the Conservatives. If they had on some questions fallen short of their duty to the nation in the years before the war, it was because of this sense of loyalty to their appointed chief. None of these considerations caused me the slightest anxiety. I knew they were all drowned by the cannonade. There was considerable pressure by elements of the Labour Party and by some of those many able and ardent figures who had not been included in the new government for a purge of the guilty men and of ministers who had been responsible for Munich or could be criticized for the many shortcomings in our war preparation. Among these, Lord Halifax, Lord Simon, and Sir Samuel Hoare were the principal targets. But this was no time for proscriptions of able patriotic men of long experience in high office. If the censorious people could have had their way, at least a third of the Conservative ministers would have been forced to resign. Considering that Mr. Chamberlain was the leader of the Conservative Party, it was plain that this movement would be destructive of the national unity. Moreover, I had no need to ask myself whether all the blame lay on one side. Official responsibility rested upon the government of the time, but moral responsibilities were more widely spread. A long, formidable list of quotations from speeches and votes recorded by Labour and not less by Liberal ministers, all of which had been stultified by events within my mind and available in detail. No one had more right than I to pass a sponge across the past. I therefore resisted these disruptive tendencies. If the present, I said a few weeks later, tries to sit in judgment on the past, it will lose the future. This argument and the awful weight of the hour quelled the would-be heresy hunters. My experiences in those first days were peculiar. One lived with the battle, upon which all thoughts were centered, and about which nothing could be done. I cannot remember, nor do my records show, how all the hours were spent. A British ministry at that time contained between 60 and 70 ministers of the Crown, and all these had to be fitted in like a jigsaw puzzle, in this case having regard to the claims of three parties. In forming a coalition government, the Prime Minister had to attach due weight to the wishes of the party leaders, about whom, among their followers, should have the offices allotted to the party. By this principle, I was mainly governed. If any who deserved better were left out on the advice of their party authorities, or even in spite of that advice, I can only express regret. On the whole, however, the difficulties were few. In deference to prevailing opinions expressed in Parliament and the press, it was necessary that the war cabinet should be small. I therefore began by having only five members, of whom one only, the Foreign Secretary, had a department. These were naturally the leading party politicians of the day. For the convenient conduct of business, it was necessary that the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the leader of the Liberal Party should usually be present. And as time passed, the number of constant attenders grew. But all the responsibility was laid upon the five War Cabinet ministers. And they were the only ones who had the right to have their heads cut off on Tower Hill if we did not win. The rest could suffer for departmental shortcomings, but not on account of the policy of the state. Apart from the War Cabinet, no one could say, I cannot take the responsibility for this or that. The burden of policy was borne at a higher level. This saved many people a lot of worry in the days which were immediately to fall upon us. In my long political experience, I had held most of the great offices of state. But I readily admit that the post which had now fallen to me was the one I liked the best. Power for the sake of lording it over our fellow creatures, or of adding to personal pomp, is rightly judged base. But power in a national crisis, when a man believes he knows what order should be given, is a blessing. In any sphere of action, there can be no comparison between the positions of number one and number two, three, or four. And the duties and the problems of all persons other than number one are quite different, and in many ways more difficult. It is always a misfortune when number two or three has to initiate a dominant plan or policy. He has to consider not only the merits of the policy, but the mind of his chief. Not only what to advise, but what it is proper for him in his station to advise. Not only what to do, but how to get it agreed, and how to get it done. Moreover, number two or three will have to reckon with numbers four, five, and six, or maybe some bright outsider, number 20. Ambition, not so much for vulgar ends, but for fame, glints in every mind. There are always several points of view which may be right, and many which are plausible. I was ruined for the time being in 1915 over the Dardanelles, and a supreme enterprise was cast away through my trying to carry out a major and cardinal operation of war from a subordinate position. Men are ill-advised to try such ventures. This lesson had sunk into my nature. At the top there are great simplifications. An accepted leader has only to be sure of what it is best to do, or at least to have made up his mind about it. The loyalties which center upon number one are enormous. If he trips, he must be sustained. If he makes mistakes, they must be covered. If he sleeps, he must not be wantonly disturbed. If he is no good, he must be poleaxed. But this last extreme process cannot be carried out every day, and certainly not in the days just after he has been chosen. The fundamental changes in the machinery of war direction were more real than apparent. A constitution, said Napoleon, should be short and obscure. The existing organisms remained intact. No official personalities were changed. The War Cabinet and the Chiefs of Staff Committee at first continued to meet every day as they had done before. In calling myself with the King's approval Minister of Defense, I had made no legal or constitutional change. I had been careful not to define my rights and duties. I asked for no special powers, either from the Crown or Parliament. It was, however, understood and accepted that I should assume the general direction of the war, subject to the support of the War Cabinet and of the House of Commons. The key change which occurred on my taking over was, of course, the supervision and direction of the Chiefs of Staff Committee by a Minister of Defense with undefined powers. As this minister was also the Prime Minister, he had all the rights inherent in that office, including very wide powers of selection and removal of all professional and political personages. Thus, for the first time, the Chiefs of Staff Committee assumed its due and proper place in direct daily contact with the executive head of the government, and in accord with him, had full control over the conduct of the war and the armed forces. Any account of the methods of government which developed under the National Coalition would be incomplete without an explanation of the series of personal messages which I sent to the President of the United States and the heads of other foreign countries and the Dominion government. This correspondence must be described. Having obtained from the Cabinet any specific decisions required on policy, I composed and dictated these documents myself, for the most part on the basis that they were intimate and informal correspondence with friends and fellow workers. One can usually put one's thought better in one's own words. It was only occasionally that I read the text to the Cabinet beforehand. Knowing their views, I used the ease and freedom needed for the doing of my work. I was, of course, hand in glove with the Foreign Secretary and his department, and any differences of view were settled together. I circulated these telegrams, in some cases after they had been sent, to the principal members of the War Cabinet, and, where he was concerned, to the Dominion's Secretary. Before dispatching them, I had, of course, had my points and facts checked departmentally, and nearly all military messages passed through Ismay's hands to the Chiefs of Staff. This correspondence in no way ran counter to the official communications or work of the ambassadors. It became, however, in fact, the channel of much vital business and played a part in my conduct of the war, not less, and sometimes even more important, than my duties as Minister of Defense. The very select circle who were entirely free to express their opinion were almost invariably content with the drafts and gave me an increasing measure of confidence. Differences with American authorities, for instance, insuperable at the second level, were settled often in a few hours by direct contact at the top. Indeed, as time went on, the efficacy of this top-level transaction of business was so apparent that I had to be careful not to let it become a vehicle for ordinary departmental affairs. I had repeatedly refused the requests of my colleagues to address President Roosevelt personally on important matters of detail. Had these intruded unduly upon the personal correspondence, they would soon have destroyed its privacy and consequently its value. My relations with the President gradually became so close that the chief business between our two countries was virtually conducted by these personal interchanges between him and me. In this way, our perfect understanding was gained. As head of the state, as well as head of the government, Roosevelt spoke and acted with authority in every sphere. And carrying the War Cabinet with me, I represented Great Britain with almost equal latitude. Thus a very high degree of concert was obtained, and the saving in time and the reduction in the number of people informed were both invaluable. I sent my cables to the American Embassy in London, which was in direct touch with the President at the White House, through special coding machines. The speed with which answers were received and things settled was aided by clock time. Any message which I prepared in the evening, in the night, or even up to 2 o'clock in the morning, would reach the President before he went to bed. And very often his answer would come back to me the next morning. In all, I sent him 950 messages and received about 800 in reply. I felt I was in contact with a very great man who was also a warm-hearted friend and the foremost champion of the high causes which we serve. The cabinet being favorable to my trying to obtain destroyers from the American government, I drafted during the afternoon of May the 15th my first message to the President since I became Prime Minister. To preserve the continuity of our correspondence, I signed myself Former Naval Person, and to this fancy I adhered almost without exception throughout the war. Although I have changed my office, I wrote, I am sure you would not wish me to discontinue our intimate private correspondence. As you are no doubt aware, the scene has darkened swiftly. The enemy have a marked preponderance in the air, and their new technique is making a deep impression upon the French. I think myself the battle on land has only just begun, and I should like to see the masses engage. Up to the present, Hitler is working with specialized units in tanks and air. The small countries are simply smashed up one by one like matchwood. We must expect, though it is not yet certain, that Mussolini will hurry in to share the loot of civilization. We expect to be attacked here ourselves, both from the air and by parachute and airborne troops in the near future, and are getting ready for them. If necessary, we shall continue the war alone, and we are not afraid of that. But I trust you realize, Mr. President, that the voice and force of the United States may count for nothing if they are withheld too long. You may have a completely subjugated, Nazified Europe, established with astonishing swiftness, and the weight may be more than we can bear. All I ask now is that you should proclaim non-belligerency, which would mean that you would help us with everything short of actually engaging armed forces. Immediate needs are, first of all, the loan of 40 or 50 of your older destroyers to bridge the gap between what we have now and the large new construction we put in hand at the beginning of the war. This time next year we shall have 20. But if in the interval Italy comes in against us with another 100 submarines, we may be strained to breaking point. Secondly, we want several hundred of the latest types of aircraft, of which we are now getting delivery. These can be repaid by those now being constructed in the United States for us. Thirdly, anti-aircraft equipment and ammunition, of which again there will be plenty next year, if we are alive to see it. Fourthly, the fact that our ore supply is being compromised from Sweden, from North Africa, and perhaps from northern Spain, makes it necessary to purchase steel in the United States. This also applies to other materials. We shall go on paying dollars for as long as we can, but I should like to feel reasonably sure that when we can pay no more, you will give us the stuff all the same. Fifthly, we have many reports of possible German parachute or airborne descents in Ireland. The visit of a United States squadron to Irish ports, which might well be prolonged, would be invaluable. Sixthly, I am looking to you to keep the Japanese quiet in the Pacific, using Singapore in any way convenient. The details of the material which we have in hand will be communicated to you separately, with all my good wishes and respect. On May the 18th, a reply was received from the President welcoming the continuance of our private correspondence and dealing with my specific requests. The loan or gift of 40 or 50 older destroyers, it was stated, would require the authorization of Congress, and the moment was not opportune. He would facilitate to the utmost the Allied governments obtaining the latest types of United States aircraft, anti-aircraft equipment, ammunition, and steel. In all this, the representations of our agent, the highly competent and devoted Mr. Purvis, presently to give his life in an air accident, would receive most favorable consideration. The President would consider carefully my suggestion that a United States squadron might visit Irish ports. About the Japanese, he merely pointed to the concentration of the American fleet at Pearl Harbor. On May 13th, I asked the House of Commons, which had been specially summoned, for a vote of confidence in the new administration. After reporting the progress which had been made in filling the various offices, I said, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. In all our long history, no Prime Minister had ever been able to present to Parliament and the nation a program at once so short and so popular." Upon these simple issues, the House voted unanimously and adjourned till the 21st of May. Thus, then, we all started on our common task. Never did a British Prime Minister receive from Cabinet colleagues the loyal and true aid which I enjoyed during the next 5 years from these men of all parties in the state. Parliament, while maintaining free and active criticism, gave continuous, overwhelming support to all measures proposed by the government, and the nation was united and ardent as never before. It was well indeed that this should be so, because events were to come upon us of an order more terrible than anyone had foreseen.